the traditional action that is considered to be, in some ways, the thing that makes one Buddhist, or the thing that that turns one's attention toward a path of liberation from suffering, a complete path of liberation from suffering, or a path of complete liberation rather than partial, is an act known in the Buddhist tradition as going for refuge. Sometimes it's called taking refuge as well, which works fine as a translation. The literal is going for, and I like the going verb rather than the taking verb. And refuge is a beautiful word. Of course, it's the root of refugee, and there's a deep. It has a deep pedigree in English and Latin, and it has implications, I think, that are profound and very, very sweet and sheltering for us in challenging times, such as we live in. Going for refuge is one of the first doctrines or aspects of formal community building that the Buddha instituted. In the very, very earliest days of the community, when the Buddha started teaching, admission to the community of monastics, becoming a monk or a nun, which was called a few things. It was called the going forth, and the long version of that is the going forth from the home life into homelessness. And this was the major turning in one's life when one decided or had the undeniable impulse that seeking liberation was the most important thing. Going forth from the home life into homelessness entailed turning away primarily from the social systems of family and children, business and money, and social class. So when you became, in the earliest days of the community called the Sangha in Buddhism, when you became a monastic or a seeker, the word samana or shramana, meaning the seekers or wanderers, you became one who is homeless, bhikkhu or bhikshu in the male, and bhikkhuni or bhikshuni for women. The Buddha, along with his contemporary Mahavira, who founded the order of the Jain religion, were the first two ascetics to admit women into the order, and quite radically to do so. And the Buddha added to the radical admission of women the radical gesture also that one lost one's social class or caste upon admission. So whether you were a king or an untouchable or a beggar, when you joined the order, you lost that, either the privileges or the oppression of your caste. And the hierarchy of monastics is purely by date or of ordination. And so if a beggar was ordained 5 minutes before the king was ordained, the king would always bow to that beggar as his senior. This had radical implications, and still does, through into the 20th century, when a socialist movement of ordaining or of converting to Buddhism was part of a huge movement of resistance to the caste system and class oppression in India. If you are Hindu and you convert to be a Buddhist, even without becoming a monastic, even as a lay people, as we are, you would lose your caste. And that's not just a metaphysical nicety, it's actually a political, legal status change. And certain things become available to you in society that aren't under the caste system. So the Buddha instituted a practice of flattening, in a way, the conditions that folks brought in with them. And this and joining the community, whether fully going forth into homelessness, to become a monk or a nun, or joining the community of believers as a layperson, supporting the monastics and taking on the teachings and the practices as your guide, was called going for refuge. And the very earliest monks and nuns simply became monks and nuns by saying that they wanted to be. And the Buddha would say, come, and to their name. So you would say, the standard passage goes something like, the Buddha has given a brilliant Dharma talk that has blown you away. And you would say, magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent. It is as if you have shined a light on that which was dark and opened the path that was hidden. I go for refuge to Master Gotama and to the Dhamma and to the community of monastics. May I be accepted as a lay follower for life. That was if you didn't want to become a monk or nun. If you wanted to become a monk or nun, it would say, may I be admitted into the community of monks and nuns. And the Buddha would respond, come, Desika, and you would be a nun. It's okay, I can't, it doesn't work if I say it, so nothing has happened. But I was sitting once with a wonderful senior monastic named Ajahn Amaro when he was the abbot of our kind of magnificent California monastery, Abhayagiri, which is up in Ukiah and well worth visiting if you have a day to spare heading up there. And sadly for us, but beautifully for them, his teacher, the most senior Western monastic, Ajahn Sumedho, retired and went back to Thailand, and Ajahn Amaro was called back to England to head the Mothership Monastery in Devon, which is great, except that he was fabulous, and I miss him being here. But he was teaching here once, and he was... someone was asking him about how you become a monk, and you become a monk by asking to become one, and then you pretty much are. And someone was saying, how do you unbecome a monk? And it's called disrobing. It basically means you turn in your robes and you put on ordinary people clothing again. And he was saying that it's really very simple. All you do is you give up the training. You go to somebody and you say, I give up the training. And someone said, what would you actually have to say to do that? And he kind of hesitated. And he was like, well, you would say, I give up the Dhamma and discipline. And then he laughed and he said, just because I just said it doesn't mean I meant it. I didn't just do it, but it was actually very sweet. So this joining the community was called going for refuge. I go for refuge to the Buddha or to Gotama, to the Dhamma or the teachings, and to the community of practitioners, the Sangha. And as this got formalized, it turned into what was called the triple gem or the triple jewel of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's the Sanskrit versions of the words, the most common versions we know. Where as it developed, going for refuge to the Buddha meant not just taking this teacher as your exemplar or your teacher, but also taking the subtle truth that the Buddha had realized, the truth of absolute full liberation, as your guiding light. And even as it developed, it would even become like as your own true nature in a certain way. And then going for refuge to the Dharma or Dhamma originally was I take on these teachings, these particular teachings, this particular view of the world and how to live in it as my guide. And in its sort of most literal interpretation, that means a bit, I take on this worldview, right? I turn myself toward an understanding of the world that there is suffering arises lawfully out of causes. Suffering is caused by grasping, by clinging, by confusion. And that uprooting those causes, uprooting grasping and clinging and fear from my own heart also ends the experience we call suffering or distress, and that that is possible through following a path. So in some ways, going for refuge to the Dharma meant kind of taking that on and setting aside other worldviews, like the worldview that performing the correct rituals to the gods would ensure liberation, that it could possibly do that, right? Setting aside a belief in sort of magic in a certain way, setting aside a belief ultimately in the separate individual self. And all of this, you know, starts off as a bit of belief, and as you practice, is revealed as insight into reality or truth. Over time, refuge into Dharma, again, it also expanded, like refuge in the Buddha expanded, to be refuge not just to the teachings, but again, to the ultimate truth to which they point. So if the teachings point to full liberation or the nature of things as they are, then later traditions would say, oh, I take refuge in the nature of things as they are. And this is a profoundly, you know, a vast vision of what refuge could be. And the third refuge into Sangha or community originally was, I take refuge in the direct kind of human community of the monks and nuns, those who have practiced and realized liberation, and then more broadly, the community of all the practitioners, both monastic and lay people. And again, later traditions expanded that into a sense of, you know, if all beings, in an ultimate sense, are already liberated action in a kind of non-dual or impersonal way, then taking refuge in the Sangha or the community can mean, bless you, not just refuge in the literal community of believers or practitioners, but the community of all beings everywhere, or the community of the realization of profound interdependence and non-separateness. So refuge partly means safety. And built into refuge as the thing that one goes for is a recognition that we may be or may feel that we are unsafe or without refuge in the world. There's the first noble truth, that there is suffering, is woven into the practice of going for refuge. You wouldn't need to go for refuge if you were already safe, if you were already sheltered from harm, but you're not. And again, the deep harm that the Buddha points to in the word suffering, dukkha is the word in Pali and Sanskrit, that we translate as suffering. I like distress, or pain. Personally, I like those words as translations. I don't actually like them particularly. The particular suffering that the Buddha points to are, in a certain way, the big existential sufferings, the reality of old age, sickness, and death, the inevitability of old age, sickness, and death, the reality of loss, of separation from that which we love, the loss of our family members, the loss of our property, the loss of our well-being, through all the various fluctuations that exist. And so, and more subtly than that, like the profound discontent that haunts every experience. I fall in love, and my falling in love is haunted by the knowledge of loss. Right? Even if we have a romantic myth and stay together for our lifetimes in bliss, as that beautiful song recently says, one of us will die inside these arms, and the other will scatter the ashes around the yard. So, refuge suggests that first we recognize that life as we've come into it has the flavor of both pleasure and pain, and that the pain part again haunts us. And because of that haunting, we seek. We endlessly seek places of safety from it, whether we think we're doing that or not. Right? I'm exhausted after an evening of work. I'm not ready for bed, but I can't really focus. I don't want to do anything. I just want to like turn on Downton Abbey, which is a fine show, and kind of lose the present moment, right, in a certain way. Lose my tiredness or my worry about the state of the country, and just be like, you know, oh my God, like Carson and Mrs. Hughes, they're flirting, they're so square, it's so cute. Like, I'm escaping for a moment, you know, into fantasy, which is fine. Right? This isn't about a judgment of that, but to recognize what's happening. That when I do that, and it's a fairly innocent escape, I have more intense ones that I pull out sometimes. But there's that one. That part of what I'm doing is I'm taking a break from contact with existential distress. Right? Can I have a break, please, from existential distress? Thank you. You know, and there's absolutely good reasons to do so, right? One of them is that existential distress, which is to say, that's just a funny way to say all of the subtle distress that we play with, stress and worry and angst and fear, is exhausting, and we don't actually have lives that are set up for constant, profound inquiry into the nature of experience and liberation, which is why one would go on retreat or become a monastic. It's actually understood in the early tradition that it's nearly impossible to become fully liberated in ordinary life when you have to deal with your family and your kids and your job and money and when, you know, you're still all about lust, really, and wanting stuff, and trying to set up your nice house situation, and, you know, and none of that lands for very long, and it's always unstable, and the home life, the Buddha said, is dusty. Dusty is the word he used. It's dusty and complicated, but the homeless life is free and clear, by which he meant not, you know, I lost my house in the Bay Area because I was evicted and now I live on the street, like several folks that I saw today, and every day living here. What he meant was sort of like being a kind of proto-hippie, like I live in the woods, you know, for free in a tent and people give me some food. It's kind of like festival life, right? And I just hang out meditating and talking about reality with my friends, which is pretty nice, actually. Refuge suggests that we recognize that without refuge we are adrift, that we're in a system that swirls us, that tosses us, that offers security or safety, but never for long, and is always precarious. And that feels like it's a new condition, but the texts describe exactly this from, you know, 2,000-3,000 years ago. The same thing, really. So we go for refuge as a way of affirming something that in a certain way has already happened. This is partly why this is thought of as a conversion admission. Like, and And lots of teachers, lots of Western Buddhist teachers, insight meditation types, spirit rock types, which is my lineage mostly, don't emphasize this much. But Buddhism in its early incarnations was an evangelical religion. It was out to convert people. And partly because the teachings are beautiful and they are liberatory, they work, I promise. I can tell you from experience that they work somewhat. And I have enough really, 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 really good teachers. I've had enough really good teachers that I can tell you they work very, very well if you devote yourself to them profoundly. And it doesn't get emphasized much that going for refuge can be a very serious thing. That in part what you're doing is you're saying, the world as it's been taught to me no longer works for me. It actually doesn't work to just be pursuing gain and comfort and essentially living in denial that those things are already slipping out of our fingers as soon as we get them. The Buddha described refuge as an island in the middle of a raging stream, where you're being tossed around and really battered by life. And you take refuge and you're sheltered from that. Why would going for refuge to a body of teachings and a community of kind people, how would this be a shelter from the storm, from the waves? The first teaching, in a certain way, once you have aligned yourself, and often it kind of goes in reverse, right? You take refuge because you have already been inspired by the tradition. That's usually how it would happen in the text. The Buddha would give a teaching and would say, this is how it is, and someone would be inspired, wow, that's really, really good. I go for refuge. So you've heard something that draws you toward the tradition. And then going for refuge is a way of saying, I'm taking this on. And there's nothing permanent about it in any sort of legalistic sense. It's more like an inner vow that arises naturally in you when someone shows you something that's true, right? If someone says, hey, this constant trying for satisfaction through, stuff and relationships, that doesn't work ultimately. And if you want an ultimate happiness, you have to look somewhere else. And if you believe that, if that makes sense to you, and I hope it does, because it's true, as far as I know, then going for refuge you're not leaving behind anything valuable when you go for refuge. You're just leaving behind, you're leaving behind fake news. And you're deciding to believe in actually what you experience directly. And to believe good teachers. So we go for refuge. And it shelters us because immediately it pulls the plug on some of the harshest messages that are constantly hitting us. Right? Immediately, you can say, oh, I'm turning my attention toward letting go. I'm turning my attention toward clear seeing or kindness rather than believing that consumption is going to work. That does so much immediately. that it can feel like the waves have quieted down. Right away, it can feel like that. I have a student who came to me because she wanted to take refuge, and for many, many months, we just talked about it. We read texts, and we did some we did trauma work, and we worked on it, and we didn't delay because it was because it was complex to take refuge. We delayed just because it took that long to kind of, to almost like to get our heads above water long enough to even see that there was an island right there. Like, sometimes you're so tossed. There's first you have to just like stabilize a teeny bit, and then you can say, you know, how can I shift this? When we finally did a refuge ceremony, I took her to a teacher that I love who does a formal refuge ceremony. We could have done it ourselves, but it was good for her to go to a senior teacher and do it in a very traditional way. And she cried through the whole thing. And the traditional ceremonies, the teacher would do these chants and say, like, repeat after me. You know, I go for refuge, da-da-da. She couldn't say a single word of it. She just wept the whole time. And the teacher was very sweet. He said, it's okay, I'll say it for you. You know. When things are such that my own confusion is really whipped up, and the events of this month are substantial in that direction, if I believed that there was such a thing as like fixing the system under which we live, so that it would once and for all be fixed and good for everybody. If I believed that were possible, I would really feel hopeless right now. Or like, we have so much work ahead of us that I'll never see it in 100 lifetimes. Which is true. The thing that keeps me from feeling hopeless is that I don't believe that. I don't hinge my well-being to the idea that our system is fixable in an absolute sense. I very much see it changing over time in good ways. And it looks fairly dire, you know, as of the times this morning. But it doesn't look particularly dire compared to, you know, 1855, right, with slavery, the strongest institution in American life. It doesn't look particularly dire in relation to any number of profoundly disruptive moments in the past. But it's also not fixable in a way that I should hold on to that to find my security or happiness. So what I have in a time like this is refuge. That this body of practices and teachings actually offers something other than hope. It offers what the tradition would come to call like getting off the cycle altogether. And this is a strange promise. And it's part of an ancient renunciate tradition that saw the world as neither bad nor good, but simply like a natural system. And that something changes radically when you refuse to participate in the unwholesome aspects of that system. When you refuse to participate in the play of grasping and losing and failure, bless you. And very mysteriously, like, you don't go anywhere. right? Like the Buddha got fully enlightened. Millions of people have become fully enlightened in this system and others in different ways, or have achieved profound happiness in various ways, who don't disappear. The Buddha got enlightened at 35 maybe and walked around for 45 years chatting with people, talking about life, getting involved in politics a little bit, not very much. Setting up an institution, having a lot of suffering in the setting up of the institution, and inviting folks to go for refuge and to make this single profound shift in their orientation, in their life, that becomes the basis of everything unfolding from there. We'll pause there. I wrongly stated on Facebook today that we would do our refuge ceremony tonight because I didn't look at the calendar. Next Tuesday is actually the last Tuesday of the month. And I started in this year wanting to do this little body of chants on the last Tuesdays of the month when I'm here. And that includes doing the refuge chants. And now that I've just told you that it's a really serious thing to do, you may or may not want to do it. But you can also just do it as a I'm totally contradicting myself. You know, as a gesture of enthusiasm. And so we'll talk a little bit more about it next week, and we'll do this little puja or ceremony, just of honoring the tradition. And it's a way of both. I've been wanting to both bring in a little bit more of what I actually do in my practice, and a little bit more of really saying this is a Buddhist system that this is based in, and just offering the fullness of that in a way. Okay. So we'll play with that a bit next week, and for now, we'll just pause for a moment. Letting it rest, letting it sink in. Yeah, and thanks for your presence and for your warm attention. So we have, for the third part of our time together, some time for discussion and questions, questions about practice, whether about this topic or you know, what's up in your practice, reflections, please.
I really like the language going for refuge, and I'm wondering whether you think of that as sort of the going for water, as you would to a well every day, or like going for refuge. Going for it.
Yeah.
You'll get there.
Yeah.
It's kind of two ways that language could go.
I like both. I very much like the second, like, I'm going for it, you know. I like the implication of movement in it and an energy, and that it does mean, like, a departing from where I am and entering another situation that does something different in terms of safety or containment for me. And yeah, it takes sometimes it feels like the most natural thing, other times it feels like it takes a little warrior push, a little like going for it kind of push. Yeah. Yes.
So I want to speak kind of to the refuge in Sangha.
Yeah.
Because it's, I know for me when I started practicing, I felt very isolated in a lot of ways. Mm. And the going for Sangha seemed intimidating. It seemed like not possible.
Yeah.
in some ways, and it was like I was making a shift in terms of like starting to accept, or no, starting to like realize, okay, this consumer culture isn't working for me, I need something else, let me like try this on. And like hearing Taking Refuge in Sangha was hard because it was like my community at that time was actually reinforcing habits that I wanted to get away from. Mm-hmm. So it was, so it's kind of confusing, I think, for like early practitioners sometimes, especially like, you know, I mean, a lot of people are kind of coming from circumstances where it's like the society and the community that they're in are reinforcing what they're trying to get away from and go towards, like, in the practice. So, and I still find myself sometimes, like, going through cycles of, like, oh, now this isn't quite working for me. Like, and not to, like, you know, I've definitely come a long way in terms of not blaming other people or anything and just kind of recognizing, okay, I kind of put that as, but it still feels like painful and confusing when those kinds of things come.
Like when a group of people or a certain scene or setting isn't working for you anymore?
Yeah. And like something that you thought of as community is no longer really that for you anymore.
Yeah.
And so I understand how, like, coming to a sangha like this is definitely refuge for me, but, like, out there, I guess, it feels hard sometimes to consider community as, like, reliable refuge.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You know, refuge is a practice like any other, which means it's going to put you through your paces.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you decide to join up with a given community that seems wholesome, seems supportive of practice to you. And, you know, as soon as you get into it and you're no longer kind of a peripheral visitor, you find out that it's full of people. you know, that are just as messed up as anyone else. In a certain way, they're, you know, the only thing different about a wholesome community of practitioners and an unwholesome community of unwholesome folks, unwholesome acting folks, is that folks are trying,
mm-hmm.
right? But that doesn't mean that any community is free of confusion and you know, all of the, you know, Nietzsche's phrase, "Oh, the humanity."
Mm-hmm.
So that's the case. One of the things about joining a formal sangha that connects you to something like a big religious tradition is that it's way bigger than any given community. So, you know, if the Theravada teachings that I'm offering mostly really turn you on, but it turns out that this Tuesday night sangha doesn't, at some point, doesn't serve you, I'm not the right teacher for you, the people aren't the right people for you, but you connect with these teachings, you may have taken refuge in the Dharma and the bigger sangha such that you might find your teachers, you know, at a Loka Vihara or a Bayagiri or at James's group or up at Spirit Rock or in Burma or in Sri Lanka. You know, there's... So... But refuge in Sangha also, you know, when you're saying, like, this community or that community, it also doesn't... It relies on the thing that we feel when we connect with a group of people where we share some aspect of belief system and values and practice. But it does imply that not just any community is a wholesome refuge,
mm-hmm.
right? That folks can be doing something. You could take refuge in the community of people who love, you know, like deep house music. And it's a nice community, you know, it's good folks, good music, damn. But it may not be liberative in this kind of traditional sense, because the body of practices may not be developed in such a way as to actually lead to liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So you might find a temporary refuge there. You might find friendship and community and healing and any number of things. But it might not be a Dharma community, ultimately. and you might then continue to search. So, you know, and to be a bit ecumenical here, I think that there, you know, even certainly outside the Buddhist tradition, there are beautiful traditions that are wholesome and one can take refuge in and benefit, you know, vastly from. So you may resonate with this one or others, but the principle in a certain way is the same, that you know, refuge in Sangha is powerful, but it's particularly powerful when the Sangha is actually a wholesome gathering. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes hard to tell initially.
Yeah.
Or I should say, it's always hard to tell initially. Because some of the ones that look the most wholesome turn out to be rotten.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the case.
For me, it's been helpful understanding the refuges both in their kind of literal, traditional meaning, but in then also this kind of bigger ideas that they represent. Whereas the Buddha is, yes, is the historical Buddha Gautama, but it's also the idea that we all have this Buddha nature, this potential for enlightenment. And the Dharma for me is the teachings of Buddhism, but also just truth and like the way of the universe. And kind of thinking in that way. And then Sangha, for me, is like just this interdependent nature of reality, that we're all kind of in this together. And so it can be like this idea, and not just necessarily a specific community, too. And I think holding both of those has been helpful for me, like seeing, because I first learned about the refuges as like, this is what makes you a Buddhist. You take refuge, and then you are a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really resonate with that as much. It's like, oh, I can kind of take refuge, but still not necessarily only identify as a Buddhist, just like...
Yeah. Yeah, we're not really joiners, our generation. Yeah. Which is fine. And those teachings of the refuges in their vast qualities, they emerged in what's called the Mahayana, so several hundred years after the Buddha, as the teachings developed and were filtered in a way through an orientation away from the relative practices of letting go of grasping to move toward a deep renunciation of the causes of suffering, toward an orientation toward the absolute level of existence, toward vast non-duality, vast interconnection. And that's beautiful, and those teachings are often very resonant for folks here and now. The one thing that I caution folks about around them is that because of their very vastness, they can be unspecific. And it can be the case that they are so vast that they, in a certain way, don't help me as much in the face of direct, like, relative suffering. Like, I'm totally, like, miserable and having a terrible time, and I kind of know that my true nature is vast, unlimited beingness and love, but it doesn't actually help. And so then my practice actually has to be quite vigorous to be under that umbrella. But as you're saying, they offer a doorway to something that's so much bigger than my small individuality and the way that I might interpret a tradition that says, you know, you do this to belong to this. Like we don't like believing in like this one teacher or this one body of teachings. And I'm saying we quite vaguely now. I don't know, right? I don't know you so well, so I don't know what you believe. But what you're saying is quite common, and I hold those myself. And more and more, as I suffer, I enjoy the kind of literal and somewhat earlier interpretation that they can refer to very specific shifts in my worldview that that help me withstand the onslaught of. The world. So they're both in there, and you're certainly speaking to a very profound wing of the tradition, right? In certain ways, a more mystical wing, right? In some ways.
Yeah. I guess I just want to say, like, I really appreciate what Stephanie is saying, because I think that there's a practical aspect of community and sangha that is, it's like this loneliness and this isolation is real and like immediate and is a true suffering, you know, that we can face in ourselves like every day really. And yeah, there's like difficulty in community. I kind of wanted to like just ask a little bit too about this, there's difficulty in community. And there's like value in community. There's value in relationship. There's difficulty in relationship. There's grasping in relationship. There's aversion in relationship. But there's like something that is, I guess I'm not willing to deny the necessity of community, of the relationship that is community.
Yeah.
It's a greater and more, like, it's kind of like a, more like a, it's like a, there's a dissolve, there's a less of an intensity when you spread it out with a bunch of people and the community is larger, you know, and there's something that holds you a little easier, I think. But,
yeah, absolutely, that's why it's the third of the gems, right, it's refuge and community. Fusion Sangha. For me, part of what's precious about, let's say, Sangha as different from another kind of community is that in Sangha, you know that everyone has at least some of the same kind of either messages or practices or teachings. Let's say on the very basic level of like, you know, an intention to keep the ethical precepts. So folks are intending not to cause harm. And so refuge in Sangha partly is a way of saying, I'm gonna move toward being in communities of people who I can trust. Not that they're not going to make mistakes or be challenging, because of course they are, but that I trust their intention, you know, as best I can, like, as best people can be, right? You trust that folks have, are trying.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it, you know? They want to live ethically. They want to be kind. They want to be generous. And they fail, you know, sometimes. But that's different from being out and about in the swirl of, like, I don't even know what people are really intending. Maybe they're not intending to be generous and kind. They're intending to get what they want or whatever. Sangha is supposed to be a place where all the usual difficulties of people are there, but I feel safer. Right? And part of that is because we share something. And then within the Sangha, you just have to work things out. Like being a monastic, you know, is a teeny bit about getting really good at meditation, maybe. Maybe a lot of it is about, you know, having an ongoing spat with Brother Anthony because he likes to keep the windows open and I would rather he close them. And then, you know, trying to figure out why some monks are you know, get jello after the meal and they don't only serve to four people and why, and I want some. And then, you know, this person gets promoted before the other person. And, like, it's people, right? You know, when I was at the Zen Center and I was the cook at this small Zen Center in New Mexico, one of the duties of the cook was after the meal, everyone would gather in the kitchen to do the cleanup, and the cook would kind of randomly assign cleanup jobs to people. And so it was my job to go around and go, you know, pre-wash, wash, rinse, dry, put away, floors, counters, you know, like that. And one day I was just sort of doing that, and I really tried to just make it super random. But in a certain way, people would also always stand around in the same spot in the room. And I went to this one guy who's this kind of, who had lived there long time, kind of older fella, older than me anyway, Grumpy, that was my interpretation of him. Larry was his name. And I went, Larry, wash. And before I could even get on the group, he said, I always wash. And I could feel myself wanting to be like, no, you don't. I'm random. But I was like, and then the part of me that just like doesn't do conflict was like, fine, dry then. Jim, wash. And it's like, just like, don't get into it. But that's Sangha, right? Like, whatever for our vow to like take whatever's offered and just do our selfless service. I always wash. Totally, maybe so. I'm sorry. You know, so. Something like that. Yeah, refuge in Sangha is a refuge from loneliness, from separation at its root, I think. Yeah, I think it's partly why we come to this thing. Like, maybe you come here because you love hearing me talk about shit. But I bet that's not the case for everyone. And it's really nice to come into a room of good people and to chat a bit and to practice together. It's really nice. Which makes me think we should have another picnic. So as soon as it stops raining, we'll have Sangha picnic number two. Anything else before we close? Please, Rita.
I'm feeling from today at work a lot of residue of negative energy. And it's not Sangha to me, but it's like my... So I work in homeless shelters with youth in Oakland that have experienced all sorts of trauma and, you know, in prostitution or addicted to drugs. And it's just, like, chaotic and very stressful to be in that environment the whole day. And and then I just feel the residue. And I'm wondering, like, how I can cleanse myself of that in practice and feeling like more supported and I don't have the words for what I'm trying to express in terms of like I think I need it like I want to take refuge in a teaching and something that will just help me to stay centered.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You can't stay anything, but you can return to center again and again. Of course, that's what you mean. I mean, there's a lot of things. We could just chat about it. You could find a practice in a lot of different ways that could help you do that. Without going into it to sort of options in depth, first thing that occurs to me is I wonder what it would be like to make a little ritual for yourself that like when you come home you take a shower and you go to your altar and you light a candle or you do whatever you do there and you take refuge or you do something that in a sense makes the gesture of reestablishing yourself as yourself in your center in your space. I mean it could be a 3-minute thing, like it doesn't have to be a drawn out mystical encounter with your own inner goodness, which is always there anyway. But a ritual, because you could do it every day and because it can be a kind of strong gesture to just remind yourself, basically, of what you already know. And you could build that as simple or as complex as you want. I like simple. But a lot of refuge is really just reminding ourselves what we value. So, whatever works to remind ourselves of that. Yeah. So thanks everyone for being here. It's a pleasure. So next week we'll do our little, I'll bring chant sheets. We'll do it's like you know, 10 minutes, 5 minutes really, chanting refuges and precepts. And if you're new to that, you can come and just experiment with it. And it's just a part of what we'll do. We'll talk and meditate and do everything as usual anyway. 2 weeks from now, I'll be away. And there'll be a sub, and then I'll be back for the duration. Next Saturday is the new year in the Chinese and Himalayan systems. We leave the year of the fire monkey and good riddance, I say, and enter the fire rooster. And I don't know what that means, really, but I'm glad for a shift, whatever it is. So yeah, and next time I see you, I will have turned 46. So whatever that means, either. I don't know. Our offering tonight, as always, fully on gift economy. That means that your generosity supports others to come and supports even the tiniest transition we can make away from capitalism as the law of nature around here. Thank you for your generosity. Donations go in the basket and are split in half between the studio and myself. So see you next week. Take very good care.